What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined with Senior Reporter Carissa Bell. Hello, Carissa.
Hello, hello. I'm happy to be here.
Hello, happy to have you here. We're going to be talking about LlamaCon and Meta's, I don't know, ambition around AI and why it all seems so desperate. Also, podcast producer Ben Elman is here. Hello, Ben.
I really want to hear what the snacks were like at LlamaCon. That's always our top priority on the podcast.
That's what's most important. I mean, when we do a live event, I think that's one thing Sherlyn tends to ask for. Like, we got to see the snacks, got to see the spread. Mostly because, guys, like, this is like our chance to eat something before you spend a day running around. I'm sure you were like on your feet all day, Carissa. So you're a trooper for covering that. That was Meta's first LlamaCon. We'll dive into all that stuff. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We've gotten some good emails lately, and actually one I'm turning into one of our Ask Engadget sections. So, you know, your message, your question can go far at Engadget. Just send us your thoughts. And we typically broadcast live around 11 a.m. Eastern Thursday mornings. We're doing it at 10:30 a.m. Eastern. Just stay tuned to our YouTube channel and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You'll see when the stream is set up, but typically sometime around then, Thursday morning, we'll show off gadgets and also just banter with the audience. So join us for that. So LlamaCon happened. I don't know if anybody was particularly excited about this, Carissa, because I was watching the YouTube chat for the live stream leading up to it. Not many people there. Typically for a tech event, you start to see like the bros come in, like thousands of viewers like watching on YouTube. Maybe they were watching on Facebook or somewhere else, but it was like hovering between 500 and 800 viewers for a long while until the stream began. What was your feeling on the ground there? Were people actually excited to hear about what's going on with Llama?
Yeah, it was kind of a weird event. And I think Meta also was like weirdly trying to not have expectations be too high. Like, we didn't really see them like hype it up too much beforehand. You know, usually before like Connect or something for weeks, you know, Zuck is teasing little updates and you hear stuff. I mean, they weren't even sharing live stream was going to be until like maybe the day before or something. So that was a little odd. I will say the people there, you know, I think the developer crowd, they get to go to Meta's headquarters and go to an event. So I think there's always like a little bit of excitement there. It was definitely a smaller crowd than what I've seen even at the more recent Connects, which themselves were smaller events than what that event, you know, was pre-COVID. But, you know, people seemed excited. It definitely felt more low-key. It felt more kind of laid back. There was fewer sessions, you know, much lighter schedule. You know, so it was kind of an interesting sort of feel. And then, you know, I was wondering, like, you know, is this going to turn into a bigger event? Is Meta just kind of experimenting with the generative AI event? And, you know, it felt like, you know, maybe they're also just trying to figure out what they want something like LlamaCon to be.
I feel like that kind of is it, Carissa. Like, well, first of all, what is Llama, right? Llama is Meta's generative AI model. They're claiming it is superior to OpenAI's and others because theirs is a bit open source. There are a lot of open source proponents who say that that's not entirely true because Meta did not fully make everything fully open. They were like, I believe like somebody had torrented an early version of the model and they had like locked a lot of that stuff down. So if it's not freely available, it's not really open source, is it? But anyway, this is the AI powering, you know, the new Meta AI chat app, which we'll talk about. It's the AI that's in WhatsApp, also in where else? Messenger at this point, too. It's the AI you're talking to if you're chatting to Meta in general. Has there been anything like so far distinctive about Llama, Carissa, versus, you know, OpenAI stuff or versus stuff we're seeing from other companies?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I do think that the sort of open source components of it is something that, you know, certainly Meta tries to, you know, point out a lot. It makes themselves stand out. They talked a lot yesterday about their kind of lighter weight models, the smaller parameter ones. And like those have turned out to be really popular among a lot of developers because, you know, they're cheaper to implement. They require less, you know, computing power, et cetera. So I think, you know, they've tried to kind of carve out their own lane on that front. But it was kind of interesting because, you know, they didn't really talk too much about OpenAI and some of these other companies directly, but you really kind of got the sense that they're trying to pitch themselves as, you know, on certainly all on that same level, if not, you know, that they have some advantages when it comes to, you know, why developers should pick them over some of these other leading models.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a hint of desperation going on here. Like, over the last few years, we had the initial first year of like, oh, look at what generative AI could do. Look at what OpenAI's tech has done for Bing, and Bing Chat was a whole thing, like that early partnership with Microsoft. And now I feel like a lot of these companies are maybe noticing kind of the limits of this technology, or at least how much people actually care about it. I don't know. This whole event felt like Meta saying like, hey, we can be as good as OpenAI too. Pay attention to us here. Our model is just as good. What is interesting is that Zuckerberg was there. He was there for the tail end of the keynote for a really boring chat with the Databricks CEO. That was a really interesting choice to have that chat there rather than be, oh, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, could come right at the end of the keynote. No, he was there later that night. The Databricks chat felt like a podcast conversation, just like when Zuckerberg goes on, you know, Joe Rogan or wherever. It's like them bullshitting about like how much they love AI. I didn't get to see the Nadella chat, Carissa, but I found that idea that even Satya came and, you know, attended this thing when OpenAI has been the big partner for them. Was there anything particularly revealing about the Nadella chat to you?
Yeah, you know, that kind of had me scratching my head too, because like you said, you mentioned Microsoft does have this, you know, longstanding partnership with OpenAI. And there was a report just before LlamaCon that, you know, maybe there's some tension between Altman and Nadella, and they're sort of moving apart. It was kind of funny. They had a funny moment at the beginning where Satya talks about one of the first times he and Zuckerberg met, maybe, and Zuckerberg kind of lectured him about being not having social features, and there was like this, they kind of were like, ha ha ha, and then Zuck was like, well, you know, I think I was right. It was like a very...
He was right. Yeah.
It felt very on brand for him. And it definitely felt a bit awkward. Like, I'm not sure that, you know, I know that Microsoft does work with them on like with Azure and like the open source stuff, and that they were kind of painting that as sort of, you know, their commonality was that they both sort of have this background of supporting open source projects. But it did kind of feel like Satya was like not super familiar with everything that Llama does. You know, and Zuckerberg was kind of making the distinction where he was saying, well, you know, we don't make enterprise tools, like Microsoft or some of these other companies do. And he was talking a lot about how they use Llama internally for a lot of their work. And I thought that was kind of interesting because he was saying like, you know, it's not just that we're trying to make something that developers can use, but like we use Llama for our own, you know, services, our own research. We use it to make our own systems more efficient, so our own software engineers, you know, can be better. And so that was kind of like a good reminder of like how, you know, you're talking about, you know, how they try to like paint themselves in the same vein as, you know, a company like OpenAI or something. And a lot of what they use is like for their own benefit internally too. By
you're saying Facebook or Meta?
Yeah, Meta.
Can you give us some examples? Because right now what I'm seeing is Llama's like, it's an interesting chatbot, but we have chatbots all over the place, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that was part of the reason why they decided to launch Meta AI as a standalone app, is that like, if you're just using Facebook or Instagram, you know, you don't really like have, it's not really clear what you're supposed to use Meta AI for. Like, they've tried various ways of like pushing these features like in front of you, you know, that Instagram, they turned the search into like Meta AI queries, and it's just like feels very forced, and like it's not, you know, you don't go to an Instagram search to like find a recipe or something like that.
I hate the Meta AI integration in Instagram. I have never once did it on purpose. It's always that my thumb slipped, that I hit that like circle that is constantly moving because it's trying to be like a fast moving, you know, attractive object. And it's like, hey, do you want to like generate an image? Do you want to ask for a recipe or like ask for a story?
Right,
no,
right.
I'm just trying to talk to my friends. I've got like two or three group DMs on Instagram that I'm always adding like dumb little memes to. And you can't help me with that.
It's like when you go to a party or a store too, like there's an overeager person there like working something, right? Like they're there to support a sponsorship or something. When I go to events or something, it's like, I don't want to talk to that table. I'm sorry, I don't care about your different energy program that you're trying to sell me, which I think may be a scam. So there's always like you trying to run away from the thing that's bothering you to get the work done. But that's how I felt about Copilot in so many of these things too. Like, they've injected these AI tools into things we're all using. I don't know if anybody actually wants them. I have not heard too many people say how much they love Copilot in Windows, even though Microsoft is saying that, hey, there is engagement, there is something happening. To me, all this stuff still feels like an answer to, you know, a question that is not even being asked by a lot of users. Carissa, on your end, are you feeling that? Or are the developers like actually using this stuff and excited and think there is potential here?
Well, I think there's a difference between, you know, developers who are using a Llama model in a, you know, sort of more bespoke way for a, you know, project and, you know, taking advantage of, you know, all that knowledge and work that Meta's done, like training these models, versus them just trying to shoehorn it into every single Meta service and saying, hey, wouldn't you like love to see a Meta AI selfie of yourself like in space, right? or something that people are just kind of like, why do I need more AI slop on, you know, my Facebook feed? So like, I think that there is a distinction there. It was interesting. I think they really wanted to get to a billion, but Mark Zuckerberg right before LlamaCon said that Meta AI had almost a billion monthly users. But like, to Ben's point, it makes you wonder like how many people are just like accidentally tapping that wrong search bar in Instagram, and then they count that as like a monthly active.
I'm always wondering that, actually, because correct me if I'm wrong, Carissa, I'm not sure OpenAI has ever said we have this many unique monthly users. I think right now they go just by like the bulk queries. And so tell me about unique IP addresses accessing like ChatGPT.com or whatever. Tell me about like, you know, the number of registered accounts or the number of paid accounts that are like regularly using ChatGPT. Because if you just go by the number of queries, you could just have a small number of people who are providing like the bulk of the questions. These people who, you know, we're hearing more and more stories about them are using ChatGPT as Google now for like zero click web searches.
I mean, that's all a part of it. Like, how you count these stats, it's gone back to like web ads. You know, what is an actual page view? How do you actually count these things?
Yeah, Carissa, what do you have to think about that?
Yeah.
Well, and I think a lot of this too is that, you know, Meta is a public company and that they have they're probably more constrained. They have a very long history of like how they count user metrics for different products and how they disclose them. And that's, you know, very different for a public company versus someone like OpenAI, where they don't have to, you know, they don't have the same kind of obligations as a publicly traded company. And so maybe they have different things that they're tracking, and they're not, you know, they don't have like a long history of making all these other kind of consumer tech products where you really want to see, you know, number go up every month in terms of like engaged daily or monthly active users. I think your point is right, though, that like, you know, I think to some extent, a lot of these like user stats are all like kind of meaningless because there's so many different ways that you could like slice that data to look, you know, like your thing is the best or the most popular or the most used thing. So like, I think with any tech company, we should always take like all these metrics with like a pretty big grain of salt.
Especially when they've like forced this tool into apps that are already on like billions of people are using, right? Like Facebook is such a widespread company across the Facebook app, across Instagram and everything, WhatsApp, all of its tools, like they're combining all that to be like, this is our user base and we can force these things into all of them. Did they mention anything about that Wall Street Journal report, Chris? I'd be interested to know. There's a report that Meta's digital companions are having sex chats with users, including children. They can get a little raunchy, and it's honestly genuinely gross. That report was from April 26th. Zuckerberg has also gone on record saying he's done apologizing for things, like when his companies do bad things. So did he say anything about this? Did anybody mention this?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. And, you know, I think especially when I remember when they first launched Meta AI a while back, and they're kind of like just upfront, we're like, it's going to make mistakes. It's going to hallucinate.
Yeah.
You know, generative AI is still, you know, very much an experimental thing. So, be prepared and we're going to fix stuff. So I feel like they would say like this just like falls into that bucket of, you know, oops, like the AI did a thing we didn't expect, but, you know, moving on.
Moving on. I still can't get over how he was just like, I'm done apologizing for things. Your platform enabled a genocide, sir. And you're done talking about that? But anyway, let's roll out this technology, which we don't fully control or understand. That makes a lot of sense. The other thing that's a little weird about LlamaCon is that Meta announced their latest models just a couple of weeks ago, right? Like, there were a couple of Llama 4 models that were announced. We're all still waiting to hear about the kind of big one, the supposed, quote, reasoning model.
Behemoth.
That could compete with the, yeah, the latest.
Wait,
stuff
it's called Behemoth?
Yes.
It's called Behemoth.
Oh,
it's called
goodness.
They have all these AI-generated llama photos, too, or captions. But yeah, it's called Behemoth. That's the one that's going to compete with, like, whatever the latest OpenAI stuff. It is weird that they made that announcement before LlamaCon. I feel like at the very least you would announce the new models at your freaking AI conference, right?
Yeah, I agree. That felt a little weird. I thought, well, maybe they'll, as like, it feels too soon, but like maybe they'll release Behemoth or something. But nope, they released them. I think Scout and Maverick are what the current Llama 4 models are called. They talked about those. We did also get like several teases to a smaller Llama 4 model, which Zuckerberg kept calling Little Llama. He was saying that was kind of their cute internal nickname for it. And that's going to be the successor to that kind of smaller, lightweight Llama 3 model that I mentioned before that's really popular. That was referenced several times throughout the day, and I thought that was interesting. I think that because of the popularity of the existing one, they're really expecting that one to be a big thing for developers. So I thought it was interesting that they kept talking about Little Llama a lot as well.
Gotcha. Like, for people who don't play around with the generative AI tools, like, if you're doing that, like, if you're using a Mac, right, and you're running the Mac Whisper stuff, or you want to use some of these GPT things, you have to download these data sets. You have to download the model to your device. It's being run on your device. It's often taking up RAM and doing stuff too, which is why there's a need for more RAM in PCs and AI PCs, but also a need for MPUs to kind of chew up all that data. You just also have to download this freaking massive file. Whereas it's kind of a difference from where we, for the past decade, we've been kind of just leaning on the cloud for everything, and there's a lot less stuff happening on your device. With AI devices, your phone, AI PCs, more is happening on the device, and that's kind of interesting. It will be interesting to see like what these companies could actually do with these tools, because I think the most interesting thing we've seen is what Apple's tried to do with Apple Intelligence. And even that was kind of messy. Like, it's led to a lot of issues that they've had to apologize for. Everybody's kind of just stumbling into these tools, and like, we don't fully understand what the problems can be. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at. Chris, do you have any takeaways from LlamaCon, or kind of what your thoughts about how Llama is going for Meta in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has talked a lot about how they want Meta AI to be the most used Gen AI assistant. Like, I think he really wants to like compete, you know, and be seen in like the same way as OpenAI or Anthropic or, you know, any of these other companies. So I think like this is like really was kind of them just sort of trying to like plant their flag and saying like, look at us, we're Meta. This is kind of what we can do. On the other hand, like, it was kind of a little underwhelming. There wasn't a lot of news. There was a new API, which, you know, I guess will be useful for developers. You know, so it just like kind of felt like a strange fit for them. But I think something interesting that came yesterday during their earnings call was Mark Zuckerberg kind of like casually just mentioned in his opening remarks that, you know, talked about their plans to eventually monetize Meta AI. And then when you think about that in terms of like the standalone app, you know, he mentioned ads and maybe product placement, and then maybe they could even have like sort of a more premium, you know, subscription-based service for people who want sort of like, you know, extra more powerful features. And then when you start thinking about that in the through the lens of like, okay, now they have like a standalone app and why they're pushing this so much, like, it starts to make sense that like this is also a major business opportunity for Meta's core business. You know, like, they want to put ads in this stuff. So when you think about that, you're like, okay, this makes more sense, and like, you know, for their whole business and not just as like a developer play.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, go ahead then.
I am bored with this line of like my own line of reasoning that I'm about to put out, which is that like, people, you know, surrender all of their like higher level critical thinking to these Gen AI models. Like, there are better ways to attack this problem, but like, it still seems relevant because there are some people who are like, yes, I'm going to ask the magic computer like what I'm supposed to do. And then Meta is just going to like put an ad in there. And are people just going to lap it up? Are they going to be like, oh, actually, obviously, Heinz is the best ketchup.
How have we used the internet for the last 25 years? You go ask Google a question, you get ads with all the search results, right? Eventually, like it didn't start out with ads at the top. But to me, I see that reasoning there too. But I also think a lot of these companies want to sell their AI access to like higher level cloud-based AI maybe, because you're essentially selling renting computing to people too. So same for OpenAI, same for Copilot Pro or Plus or whatever it's called now too. You pay a little more, you get faster responses, you get maybe slightly smarter AI. They want you to get addicted to this stuff so that you cannot live without it. You want to always be able to talk to your AI. You want your assistant to manage your schedule for you, but now you have to pay for it rather than something being run entirely on your device too. So it's all a part of it. I'm not too surprised. I just wish I wish it was more interesting. You know, I don't know. I'm just not super impressed at this point. There are things I'm impressed with. Like we've talked about the Descript tool. I use Mac Whisper for transcription sometimes too. That stuff is genuinely great. The fact that we can get like live stream captioning in a lot of like video stuff now too, like a lot of that's AI powered. So there are benefits to it. I don't think it's entirely useless, but I think these companies, the whole bet on it as they have, as Microsoft has, it still remains to be seen if it's going to be useful, but we'll be keeping an eye on it. We'll be keeping an eye on the future of Llama and generative AI in general. Thank you so much, Carissa. And we'll stay tuned, folks. Let's move on to some other news that's happening around the web. And we saw the big news, actually. A court has ordered Apple to stop collecting fees for purchases made outside the App Store. And as a result of that, Epic Games says it's bringing back Fortnite for iOS in the US next week. As a result, we've talked about this, like as that ruling came down. This was the ruling by Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers, ruled that Apple violated her own ruling back from 2021. That was the Epic Games lawsuit. Essentially, what happened is that Apple continued to collect fees for transactions that were occurring outside of the App Store. That wasn't part of the additional deal. It was supposed to be no fees at all. And I believe Epic's Tim Sweeney complained again that that was happening.
And, this is the reason why you can't, like, get a Spotify subscription inside the Spotify app, because Spotify doesn't want to pay the, like, little fee that Apple would charge.
Which is fair. Which is totally fair, too. And I think that's what people were just basically asking for. And Apple had started to cut down on that stuff and had started on cutting down from the in-app links that would take you outside the App Store. But they were still apparently taking a cut from those. Also, as part of the new ruling, I mean, the judge is, I believe, saying that the warnings Apple has been putting down there to say, like, hey, this transaction could be unsecure because it's not happening in our little playground. This could be dangerous. Those have to go away as well. That'll be interesting. It'd be interesting to see, like, this is a very, I think it's probably a just move to slap Apple for this. Chris, do you have any thoughts on, like, this particular ruling and just, like, what this means for Apple at this point?
I mean, I only read part of it and it was scathing.
Like, it was rough.
Unusually very, very, even pointed feels like an understatement for how she was describing Apple executives' conduct here. So I thought that was very interesting. She also directly said that there was one Apple executive who straight up lied on the stand. So that kind of makes you wonder what's going to happen there. That's certainly not something you want one of your executives to be known for. Also, like, it was kind of wild to me because I went back and, you know, you forget reading this, that actually, like, Apple largely came out ahead in the Apple Epic trial, except for this one point. And then it just shows you, like, how I think, you know, they just kind of thought they were, like, above having to actually comply with something like a court order. Like, it's, you don't really think of, like, Apple as doing this kind of, like, brazen sort of, like, corporate behavior, like, the same way you think of a company like, you know, maybe Meta doing something like this. But, I mean, it's, when you read the ruling, you realize, like, that, like, how brazenly they acted and just, like, completely ignored this court order, and like now it's coming back to bite them. And just reading through some of that ruling was pretty wild to see.
The judge specifically says, we quote, Apple sought to maintain a revenue stream worth billions in direct defiance of this court's injunction, end quote. So I imagine they're pissed that this is happening at all. But also, like, I feel like Apple has been so like the EU stuff, right? The sort of like third party app stores in the EU, they've been very, very pushy in terms of like how much they've allowed. And like, I think they've been testing the courts all around the globe. It is kind of crummy, but we're also living in a world where people just do not listen to judges anymore, because who needs the law? Who needs legal frameworks anymore? I don't know. We're going to keep an eye on all this stuff. Something that's not as big as this news, because there's going to be punishment for this for sure. We saw this morning, actually a couple minutes before we went live, Microsoft is raising prices on the Xbox Series S and X. They're going to start at $380 and $550 respectively. Let me see here. Yeah. So that's up almost $100 for both. It's basically $80 from what I see here. Hey, this is Tariff Watch. Back to Tariff Watch. Gadgets that have existed just fine for the past 5 years are now more expensive. And we're going to see more and more of this stuff. I don't know if you care, Chris. I don't know if you've been waiting to buy an Xbox Series X. I also feel like a lot of people, if you cared, you probably would have done it already. Not a great sign. It's a sign that a lot of things are going to be bad pretty soon. There are all the reports, too, about, shipments coming into the ports around the U.S. being empty. Like, nothing's coming in. A lot of imports we're going to feel. Like, we're going to feel the burn in a lot of different ways, from our food, you know, our food infrastructure to gadgets like this. It's going to be rough out there, folks. I don't know. Tariff Watch 2025 continues to be pretty, pretty bad. And also pretty bad, there's another NPR report about how much Doge has been overreaching. Jenna McLaughlin, who wrote that really, really great piece about Doge workers getting into sensitive data. Now they're saying Doge employees have gained accounts on classified networks that hold nuclear secrets. That's fun.
What could go wrong?
All we know is that yeah, nothing can go wrong there. These accounts, like to even get these accounts, used to require the highest level of security clearance. So not even people within nuclear regulatory agencies had access to these things. These folks did. There's no evidence that they've actually used those accounts or accessed it, but they had the ability to. And that's fun. That's just a fun thing to think about.
Can I just read paragraph from the actual report? This is literally the second paragraph of the entire thing. Luke Ferrator, a 23-year-old former SpaceX intern, and Adam Ramada, a Miami-based venture capitalist, have had accounts on the computer systems for at least 2 weeks, according to sources who have access to the networks. Prior to their work at Doge, neither Ferrator nor Ramada appear to have had experience with either nuclear weapons or handling classified information.
Just safe. And also, like, the sort of reporting that they go into here, like, the Department of Energy initially completely denied that. They said this reporting is false. No Doge personnel have access to these systems. And then later that day, there are accounts. Don't worry about it. They were never activated and have never been accessed. So just trust us. You can't trust anything any of these government agencies are saying anymore. So basically everyone is just lying outright. Fun times.
It's also really interesting that access to these networks usually requires queue clearance.
Yes.
And that's just bringing the whole weird conspiracy fever swamp all together, because
that's true.
That is the that's Q true. In QAnon.
Did we, has anybody figured out who Q is yet? Have we solved that mystery? I don't know.
Several people in my family have security clearances, work for the government. And, you know, it's so frustrating when you hear them talk about the hoops they have to jump through, like not just to, you know, get that and maintain that clearance, but just like their normal IT practices, like can't use Bluetooth on your computer, can't use a, you know, your own mouse or something like that. Like just, you know, ridiculous mundane things that they have to, you know, go through to, you know, maintain like proper
security. And when you
protocols.
Say your own mouse, you're like, you can't buy like an ergonomic thing. You actually have to ask the government so they can like maybe provide something that's a little more secure, right?
Yes. You know, you can't wear an Apple Watch into your office. Like, and then you just hear all these stories about all these like Doge, 20-year-old Doge employees, like just going in and doing whatever they want. And like none of those rules apply to them. And it's just kind of like, okay, so either those things never mattered, or we're just saying like, so there's just different rules for different people. Like, it's just,
yeah, it's like they're making a joke of everything and like all the security and policies we have put in place. But hey, you have the head of the Department of Defense also setting up a computer just to get direct signal access so it doesn't touch a government network, or just continuing to use Signal and sharing things with their family. It's hell out there, folks. Like, just no wonder so many technology focused outlets have been like good at reporting on this administration, because what they're doing is like a lot of bad tech stuff, a lot of bad tech behavior in general.
Yeah, all of a sudden, the tech outlets have become like government reporting outlets.
You got to be. I mean, TechDirt specifically said like, we are now a democracy, news site too, because essentially, you could easily argue that the rise of social media and the rise of like misinformation because of social media has been a direct attack on, our democracy across the world. On truth in general. So I don't know.
Let's get back to the gadgets. Let's talk about the really cheap.
Let's talk about the Slate pickup truck. Auto. Well, people are excited about this because this is essentially Slate has made a K truck style, like those tiny little pickup trucks from Japan, similar in that style, a very bare bones electric pickup truck that, after the EV credits that still exist, the $7,500 EV credits, technically costs as low as $20,000. Basically, without credits, it's $27,500. But it's also very, very bare bones, right? There's no radio. There's no like display or screen inside. There's a lot of things it doesn't have at all, because it's essentially a DIY type of device, so that you order this thing, but also you spec it out to however you want. It's a very cool idea. It is like, this is actually like something I think a lot of people have been asking for, because maybe they don't want like all the fancy screens that are in the EVs right now. This is how you get the costs down, things like that. This is also a Jeff Bezos backed company too, so people have been less excited about that, because in a way this is sort of like him being like, okay, what's the anti Cybertruck? What is like the opposite of this monstrosity of technology maximalism? It is a K truck with no screen.
I would not call this thing a K truck, though. I would say that this looks a lot more like the pickup trucks, like the American built like Ford pickup trucks of like the 60s.
It has a short bed,
though. Oh yeah, no, it has a shorter bed, but like it's not a teeny little cute K truck. It's just like a pickup truck before they got massive, F-150, F-250.
I mean, I think that we've seen I know in China they have all these like cheap EVs and like interesting EVs, and like I feel like for years I keep hearing like, whenever you're gonna get some of that here in the US, like get like smaller car companies that do like cheap EVs. And I think for US like trucks makes sense. I know it's not a Chinese company, but just bringing that model here, if it actually can like stay that price, we were talking about tariffs earlier, if they can actually get a $20,000 electric pickup truck, that's going to be huge. I feel like if it even is halfway decent, just because there's nothing that exists like that right now.
But the other side of it is 150 mile range, and still, like, even if you're talking about a smaller pickup truck, you're still thinking like, oh, you should be able to tow something with this. Not if you're using air conditioning, not if you're trying to like bring a boat somewhere. So I think this is really for like runs to Home Depot, Lowe's, like whatever else, and to the close campgrounds near your house, but that's pretty much it.
It's cool that you can basically turn it into an SUV as well by like adding a roof, component to it. So this is a thing that you can build however you want.
And upgrade after the fact. So if you want upgrade to put new fact. Things yeah. on it later on, you definitely can. If you want to like put a screen on the way so many other EVs have a screen, you can. That's neat.
Yeah, the range is limited now. Like 150 is not much, although it is well below the sort of like most people drive less than 30 miles a day. that essentially, if this thing is as modular as they say, like, you could be able to, like, replace that battery pack down the line with a denser battery pack, which has happened in a lot of EVs, because I've been in my, like, should I get a cheap EV mindset for a while, and a lot of stuff has happened, apparently, like, stuff I did not quite realize. Like, the Volkswagen e-Golf, they've just raised the battery life because batteries got denser. Same for the BMW i3. So that tech has happened before. But hey, good to have a wide range of cheap EVs coming. We can't trust pricing, though. Like, we can't trust pricing for anything here. Even if this is going to be U.S. made, but it's still going to rely on components and minerals and things from other countries. So it's still, like, going to be victim to any potential, like, rising prices as well. But still, interesting little truck here. What else?
Oh, Carissa, you wrote an article about researchers messing around with public opinion on Reddit. Please, please tell us about that.
Yeah. So there was, over the weekend, the moderators of r Change My View, which is a subreddit where people post their opinions and, you know, try and ask for debate. They shared that they had been approached by a group of researchers at the University of Zurich who had basically said, hey, you know, for a few months, we were running an experiment in your subreddit where we were testing the persuasiveness of large language models. And what they had done was that they were, you know, it created all these, like, kind of dummy accounts, had gotten large language models, not just to, like, respond to people who are posting and Change My View, but they were also, like, customizing these responses, like, by looking at their past, like, Reddit posting history and, like, trying to, you know, glean as much information as they could so that they could make, you know, fine tune their arguments. And then they were, like, posting in the subreddit as if they were, you know, real people. They, like, took on different identities. Like, at one point, they claimed to be, like, a trauma counselor.
Oh, was, like, okay. So they were adopting, like, false personas too.
Yes. At one point, somebody, like, claimed to be, like, a black person who doesn't support Black Lives Matter. I mean, these are, like, pretty, you know, pretty charged topics in a lot of cases. And that they were running this for months. And Reddit had actually banned some of their accounts at one point because they had, you know, they're sort of suspicious signals. So the Reddit mods were like, hey, this has been going on. We've been going back and forth with researchers. Like, we want you, you know, to know what's going on. They broke our subreddit rules. They broke Reddit's site-wide rules. We don't want them to publish their research. Researchers jumped in who, by the way, are, like, anonymous. They haven't disclosed their names, even on the draft paper that's out there. And we're saying, oh, well, we think this was really necessary research because it can help prevent, like, more malicious attacks from, you know, other kinds of AIs. And it kind of just devolved into this whole thing where, you know, they really seem to have been broken a lot of ethical standards. They said that their research was approved by a university ethics committee. But when I reached out to the University of Zurich, they actually told me kind of a different story there.
Story did they tell you?
So they said that they were advised by an ethics committee that they, you know, they thought that the research was going to be really difficult to pull off and that they should respect any platform rules, which obviously they didn't. And that
they didn't mention any kind of, like, a IRB, like, ethics board or anything, right?
They did, actually. They said that it was. They have an IRB number. They said that it had been approved. The University of Zurich says that they're, like, revisiting their policies to evaluate this kind of project going forward. The whole thing is a mess. But, you know, a lot of people on Reddit are, I think, rightfully really upset because, like, we were experimented on without our knowledge by an AI. And, you know, that just, like, feels like a huge violation, like, besides the fact that it's, you know, legally dubious in terms of, like, Reddit's own policies for, like, how researchers are supposed to operate and, you know, how you're supposed to use this kind of thing on their platform.
That's incredible.
I assume we'll see more of this too, just because it's so easy. I think that's part of the danger of generative AI that a lot of people have not thought about, is, like, the harm you could do by creating these things. And yeah, you have the chatbots who will want to have weird, gross sex talk with kids. You'll have these things that you could just create these people to pretend to be other people too.
The interesting thing was, if you read the draft of their paper, which I guess they're now not going to publish, was that They said that the LLMs were very effective. Like, they were very persuasive.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
Which,
I mean, especially if you allow... did they say what, like, model they were using? Of, like, what model of LLM they were using?
No, I don't think so.
Unless you put guardrails on it, and unless you say, like, you know, you are not allowed to claim credentials that you don't have, like being a trauma counselor or something, how is anyone supposed to think, like, oh, yeah, okay, you know, this person is claiming some kind of institutional authority. It makes sense for me to say, yeah, they know what they're talking about. Yes, everyone can lie on the internet, and the internet might just be for lies, but you would hope that on a, like, Reddit board specifically for, like, very reasoned debate, that that would be, like, a little bit more taboo.
I mean, this is early days, right? And people just love playing with all this. Like, let's move on to the next story, which is another, like, AI hellscape. Duolingo is announcing that it's replacing contract workers with AI for content creation. It wants to be an AI-first company moving forward. I immediately saw people online, it may just be because I'm mostly on Blue Sky and people are very anti-AI there, but people are giving up on Duolingo because of this. I also think of the potential problems here, right? Because Duolingo is a tool to help you learn new languages. So a lot that could go wrong if you leave all that up to AI. So I don't know. This also feels pretty bad. And I wonder if this company and others that, like, lean too much on AI for work that humans were doing, like, if they're going to be burned by this eventually. It's a shame because I did like Duolingo. I thought they were doing good work for a long, long time. Chris and Ben, any thoughts on this?
I mean, it's not surprising in a way, just because I feel like translations is, like, one of the things that AI has gotten really good at.
Right.
Right. Especially, you know, with all these, like, large language models, like, so it makes sense, I guess, in a weird way where you're like, well, if they want to just save money, like, I can see, like, that AI is probably, like, pretty effective in a lot of areas. But it is disappointing, you know, because I think these companies just, like, aren't really thinking through. It feels like they're not thinking through the long-term implications of doing something like this. They're just kind of, like, short-term, save money, more AI, good, and, like, not actually thinking about, like, what does it mean when we're, like, just completely getting rid of, you know, work that is being done by real people, and, like, what those people can actually bring that, like, an AI probably can't, you know, like, even as good as AI is, like, there's still a lot of nuance and things when it comes to language that, like, only, you know, a native speaker is really going to understand in that way.
A lot of cultural understanding can be lost easily because I'm still getting really dumb suggestions when I try to Google stuff and Google starts recommending facts to me or things. And, like, you're not actually answering my question. This has been a week for bad AI choices, too, because there was that there's a movie announced recently with Natasha Lyonne and Britt Marling. Those can be, like, co-AI created as well, along with one of the famous, like, computer scientists. I haven't pulled this up, but that... just that idea when a lot of people who are very pro workers and pro actor and worker rights in Hollywood right now are very anti AI. It is a very weird move to take.
We are just less than a year after the strikes too, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a weird choice, Natasha.
I don't know if I'm more like, oh, this is interesting. We're not actually going to, you know, be rude. We're not going to make any human lose their job to play around with this tool. But I also feel like giving it any legitimacy right now is kind of tough. So yeah, we're going to move through a couple things really quickly too. We talked about 23andMe falling apart, wondering what was going to happen to, like, the privacy data there. The company has agreed to back a privacy advocate for customer DNA data, according to a Bloomberg report that I'm seeing here. We don't know what that means yet. Those are just words saying that they will do this thing, but maybe they will actually be, you know, true to consumer privacy there. I also wanted to chat with you both. Did you guys see the story, the Semaphore story by Ben Smith, the group chats that changed America, which is kind of hilarious because, again, it brings it back down to, we were just talking about this, like, everybody has group chats. We all, the Signal stuff, Signalgate. We all have group chats, right, where we're talking about war secrets or war plans or something, right? We just all have group chats. But apparently, for a lot of billionaires, a lot of the tech elite, including people like Mark Cuban, Ben Shapiro, the Daily Wire founder, Mark Andreessen, they've all had these, like, circles of elite group chats where it seems like they just fed off of each other. And something that began during the pandemic, but has apparently continued on. I'm not surprised by this. that happens all the time in every industry. Like, groups of people tend to get together and like talk together. But I'm not surprised that this, some of the most powerful and richest people in the country are also basically egging each other on in a way too. Did you guys have any thoughts on this?
For a group that has like railed so much against like groupthink and you know, like accused like everyone else of just like kind of being like sheep or whatever, it's kind of funny to read that they're all sort of like coordinating their own sort of like culture wars in these like secret group chats.
It's also very strange that they are, especially like Mark Andreessen, because he's also, he's always talking about like, oh, well, why is everybody talking about current thing? I hate current thing. Like, he came up with his own silly little delineation for it. He's saying, oh, well, everybody's brains have been boiled by the internet except mine.
And he's apparently the guy who also said this. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. If you're pointing a finger, there are four fingers pointing back, dog.
And also, like, they apparently have been very, very active. Like, apparently billionaires and VC heads, like, have a lot of free time. That's apparently, like, that a lot of free time to be posting. Same thing we've seen with Elon Musk on Twitter and elsewhere, too. Like, so much time to post. There's a quote here in this piece by Thomas Chatterton Williams, who is one of the worst thinkers, I think, working right now. He writes for The Atlantic. He was involved in that weird Barry Weiss, the school thing, and he's written for her publication.
He was a professor at my alma mater, unfortunately.
Was he? Oh my. Just a complete idiot as a thinker. But he says one thing here. If you weren't in the business at all, you'd think everyone was arriving at the conclusions independently, and they're not. It's a small group of people who talk to each other and overlap between politics and journalism and a few industries. So groupthink, crossing industries, it's not just billionaires. It's like high-level people in media, too. Chatterton Williams, who is basically just a writer, but also like one of these people, conservative sort of thinkers that people point to. He's not a billionaire, but he's certainly working in these elite circles, right? I don't know if you've got thoughts about that, Ben.
A thinkfluencer, if you...
Thinkfluencer.
Remember when people were saying that very earnestly in like 2014.
Remember. It's the people who got really big on TikToks and everything.
Thought leaders.
Yeah.
But the thing that like really jumps out to me is the idea of lots of people have been really, I don't know. I guess they've been kind of taught that like, oh, there's, you know, back room dealings happening, smoke-filled rooms. These group chats are the smoke-filled rooms.
It's the same as it ever was. Let me see here. There is one, the one that Andreessen was in, Chatham House, is the one that a lot of people were talking about. But apparently Mark Cuban was often like there in the center sparring with conservatives. So he, you know, Mark Cuban, guy who occasionally says good things, very centristy democratic figure, but just hilarious. Hilarious that that's also what he spent his time with. Everybody, we all have group chats. They're just like us. The elites and the rich people, they all have their group chats, except theirs can lead to fundamental problems. But anyway, check out that piece. That was a good piece over at Semaphore. The group chats that changed America. Check it out. Let's move on to, I don't know, what's going on? Do you have anything you're working on you want to bring up, Carissa?
I'm working on something on the FTC Meta trial. Which we have not talked about. We're at an interesting moment. We're having... Google and Meta are both kind of facing these big existential moments. So the trial's still, I think it's in its third week right now, maybe. But there's been some interesting stuff that's come out from, we've heard from Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, Kevin Systrom, the Instagram founder. So, stay tuned. Working on something that's kind of on some of the revelations that have come out. Because there's been some interesting stuff that's come out in the discovery and in the testimony for the trial about, a lot of it kind of stuff from Meta's past, but still kind of juicy for people who have been paying attention to the company for a while.
And another reminder, this is all happening after they bent the knee.
After they bent the knee, after they just celebrated their AI supposed leadership. Like, this is all happening in between, too. There's a lot going on for Meta.
Zuck was, apparently groveling to Trump to, you know, hoping that he could kind of intervene and get the FTC to, accept a settlement offer. And Trump's FTC said, no, thank you. So now we have a trial that they really wanted to avoid.
Yeah, we talked a bit about that, too. Like, I'm sure Trump is still mad about, like, all the things, like, all the platforms that kicked him off after January 6th and everything. Like, he's a dude held a grudge. That is one thing we know. I'm working on a few things right now. I'm building up an Ask Engadget response to something we talked about last week, I think. The listener who asked about moving to Macs. There's actually a lot going on there, and I think my advice is pretty much the same. Yeah, it's good time, but I also do a little history and lesson on Mac versus PC and kind of like where things are now versus where they have been over the last few decades. Good times for Apple, I guess. Like, yeah, a lot of good reasons to recommend their hardware.
On the other hand, like, Apple has taken so many L's recently. Apple, big L yesterday, big L in terms of not having their LLM and like AI smarter Siri stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah. Separate issues. Yeah.
It's been a real wash for them, actually.
That hasn't. But again, the Macs are still good. You know, like my main argument is just like the actual computers are good. You can take Apple Intelligence or not. You can use it or not. At least with a Mac, you're not stuck only installing software from their app store. Like, the Mac still remains the most open platform Apple has. It's not as locked down as iOS and iPads are. So that's one reason, like, it's still good and still useful. And maybe the company will see, like, the fact that people still want to get a lot of Macs, like, maybe there is some logic towards maybe opening up iOS and iPadOS a little more. Probably will never happen, but all these court orders will certainly force them to do it. Anything for pop culture picks? Anything that you've been watching, reading that you want to shout out, Carissa?
Just start watching The Studio.
So good.
It's great.
Yeah, it's great.
Can you give me a primer on what that's about? Because I know it's like Seth Rogen making fun of like movie studios and that's it.
I mean, he's a studio head, right? So that's it. It is very much competency porn. There's like a love for Hollywood and old school Hollywood and criticism of like, hey, Hollywood is now making crummy movies. Like, we're going to make a Kool-Aid movie, right? Just stupid branded IP. That's the only thing that can be movies. That's the main commentary. But it's also genuinely funny, I think. Like, what did you think, Carissa?
Yeah, it kind of has like Curb Your Enthusiasm vibes, I feel. Yep. Like, which is and also just like, you know, I'm as a Californian, I love the LA-ness of it. It's kind of fun for me.
There's also like really great camera work too, so it's always showing off LA in great ways. I think Ike Barinholtz does some great work here. Catherine Hahn, as usual, kind of steals the show. Like, they're just these, it is, I love dense, jokey shows, and this is one of those. Like, this is a show, like, you cannot look away for, like, a second because, like, it is all coming at you so quickly. So, yeah, check out The Studio. It's very good. I've been catching up on Daredevil Born Again, the Disney Plus reboot of, the Daredevil Netflix series. It's pretty good, actually. Like, it took me a while to get really into it. I really like the original version that was on Netflix. This is a good way to bring back Daredevil. My one complaint is that I think it just kind of ends. It ends at a point where I'm like, you got more, right? We spent this whole season building up to this thing that's going to happen. And okay, wait till next year, I guess, to see the conclusion of what's going to happen in Daredevil. Good stuff there. I think we briefly mentioned Sinners last week, but yeah, Sinners is also very good. Go see it.
I don't think we mentioned it all that much. Go in.
I mean, Sinners is really good. So, again, like, Ryan Coogler cementing himself as, like, a cinematic genius, somebody who is really doing, creating really interesting films out here. If you like horror, if you like movies that kind of center on music as well, like, it is tremendous. So go see it on the biggest screen you can. I think it's actually losing IMAX screens to Thunderbolts this weekend, so that's a shame. But you may have a chance to see another large format, you know, other screens like RPX and Dolby Vision may still have it for a while. Also, I hear Thunderbolts is actually good, so I'm shocked by that. I'm looking forward to seeing that. But yeah, go see Thinners if you haven't, because it deserves to be seen on the big screen, and you should see it with the crowd. Like, the crowd reaction to that movie is a ton of fun, so check that out.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Carissa online at
Carissa B on Blue Sky and on Threads.
And you can find Devendra online at
I'm at Devendra on Blue Sky, and I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Don't at me at Hey Bellman at Blue Sky. you know, all the other stuff. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.